You're listening to a Sin podcast. You can listen to this show live by tuning your radio to 90.7 or online at sin.org.au.
We at Represent would like to acknowledge and pay our respects to the traditional owners of the land on which Sin operates, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Sin Media respectfully acknowledges their ancestors and elders, past and present and emerging. We would also like to acknowledge the traditional custodians and their ancestors of the lands and waters across Australia where our content reaches. Sovereignty has never been ceded, it always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Kids should go to school. That's what we're committed to.
Why do we want it? When do we want it now?
I haven't flip-flopped. I said no originally, then I said yes, then I have said no, and I've stuck to it.
I didn't need to do this. I've already done a lot of wall for the election.
The English fought a civil war over this matter.
Don't deal with the nuance of the Canberra bubble.
I don't know what to do with it. We have so much money.
What we want is more learning in schools and less activism in schools.
Issues that perhaps may be controversial today, but 30 years from now, your children, your grandchildren are going to be thankful that you stood up for what was right.
Represent.
Represent.
Represent. You're listening to Represent.
I'm Declan, and this is your 4 o'clock news hit. WA John Quigley has announced plans to stand down as Attorney General and is the MP for Butler. Opposition Leader Peter Dutton has accused Labor of cutting funding for border protection, linking this to the mainland arrival of 39 asylum seekers. Claire O'Neill accuses Peter Dutton of telling easily disapprovable lies over border force funding. Tasmania's unique electoral system means all bets are off on whether the Liberals will continue to hold the only state that is not held by Labor. Nationals Deputy Perrin Davey reveals a health issue behind apparent slurring in the Senate 2 times. She said her apparent slurring was result of 2 emergency operations and an 11-day stint in hospital after absences erupted behind her tonsils in 2019. The incident had left her with ongoing speech challenges, she said. The National Party has hit back at renewed calls for alcohol breath testing in Parliament, saying they've been using breathalysers. Woolworths CEO has left and resigned 2 days after walking out of his Four Corners interview. Taylor Swift jet with Travis Kelce on board arrived in Sydney, Australia, and met with Taylor Swift ahead of her 4 sold-out shows this weekend, and Victoria Police have released their social media posts quoting that they knew the Taylor Swift crowds weren't going to be trouble when they walked in, and over the 3 nights and almost 300,000 fans of the star in the attendance, they made no rests.
You're listening to Represent. Thank you, Declan, for bringing us the news.
My pleasure.
As always, it's great to hear from you. We have a very exciting episode with 3 interviews, and so, you know, we're technology permitting today. There's some Taylor Swift and music festivals. I think we've turned into the music show, but you'll hear
more about
that.
We're stealing all the music festival talk.
We are.
The big show for everything.
But most importantly right now, virtually in the studio, we have Associate Professor of Finance at RMIT University, Angel Zhung. Angel, how are you today?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks so much for having me today.
Thank you for coming in virtually. It's very convenient for us. It means everything can be super snappy. And most importantly, were you at any of Taylor's shows on the weekend?
No, unfortunately, I couldn't get a ticket. I've been watching a lot of videos, captured by the fans online. So, I mean, well, in that sense, I feel like I've been there.
Yeah. No, that's right. I've heard there's been a couple of people I know who have gotten COVID from it, so maybe you dodged a bullet.
Oh, really? Oh,
yeah. Well, I mean, big event. Not totally surprising. But we're going to talk about the economy, which totally baffles me, but you seem all over it. So we'll just start very generally. How much is it of an asset is the music industry to the economy generally and in Melbourne and Australia? How much influence does it have over the economy?
Yeah, so I think this Eras Tour in Australia is an incredible boost to the local economy. So I would say that the direct effect on the economy is around $558 million on the economy.
Was this Taylor Swift's impact on the economy?
Yes,
in Australia, right. Here, or is that for both the Sydney and Melbourne shows, or just... Sorry, I'm Casper, by the way. Hey, Angel.
Hi, Casper.
I just wanted to ask you, so was that figure of 558 million, is that specifically for Melbourne or for Sydney as well?
So I've combined both Sydney and Melbourne. So because there are around, according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics, only 1.7% of the Australian population will get a ticket. And based on an average estimate of $900 per head of spending, I arrive at an estimate of around $558 million.
Wow, that's a big number.
Exactly, it has a big number, and it is an incredible boost to the economy.
So that $1.2 billion that has been thrown around, that is a myth, as much as it's a very exciting figure.
It is exciting, but I would say that it's exaggerating the economic impact.
Yeah. I'm just going to introduce you to... So Declan is sitting in the studio too. And so if you hear a third voice, Declan, do you want to introduce yourself and ask a question?
Sure. Hello, Angel.
Hello, Declan.
Hello. So I was wondering, like, you've said that the economic impact will likely extend beyond New South Wales and Victoria, positively affecting the whole country. Could you please take us through how a show playing only in two states can have such a national impact?
Absolutely, because I've been seeing, because I couldn't get tickets, but I've been seeing a lot of social media posts about, you know, fans coming from all around the world, especially from New Zealand. So if fans are coming from, you know, overseas, they wouldn't just come, many of them wouldn't just come for a concert. They would also take this opportunity to experience all the beauties, the thin sights and the winery that Australia has to offer. So that is why the impact of this Eras Tour in Melbourne and Sydney will actually extend beyond those two states. And I think overseas fans will take the opportunity also to travel around Australia.
So it's a tourism boost as well, not just a concert boost that she's bringing in.
That's right. Wow. So we're talking about, there is some direct impact, which is a good impact from international tourism.
Yeah, wow. Okay, fair enough. And so how many people from... Did you specifically mention the number of people that have come from overseas?
We don't... unfortunately, we don't have a figure as yet. But looking at news report, for example, just last week, right, before the concert, Melbourne Airport was really busy. So you can see the passion of fans coming around the world as well as coming from other states.
Yeah, right. Wow. Wow.
And I think we heard, was it Jetstar? I might be getting the wrong brand. Said they had like a 30% more than usual for February. It's crazy, crazy stats there. So we also have another big name in the country at the moment. Pink is running around touring with her Summer Carnival. Is part of Taylor Swift's quote-unquote boost in the economy or the money that she's bringing in? Could that figure being, even though it's not the $1.2 billion, still being such a high figure, could that have something to do with having multiple stars in the country at once?
Yes, that's a great question. And I do think that the Pink Tour will also bring some direct economy boost to the economy. But it will be slightly, my estimation is that it will be slightly lower than the Eras Tour. First, I think they're targeting different different audience. They have different fan base. And Pink, Pink is running a large number of concerts in a large number of cities. That means they actually reduce the travel cost of fans, which is why the the boost to the economy will be slightly lower than the Eras tour.
So she's covering more ground, and therefore Taylor Swift has had a bigger impact due to the sort of surrounding costs that come with sort of hotels, the flights as well.
Yes, that's right. And not to mention about the merchandise that the Swifties are buying.
Yeah, the merchandise has been incredible. I don't think I've missed... I walked past on Friday, past the MCG, and there was lines for... It seemed like it would take hours to get something. Can you speak bit more about those figures?
Yes, I think there's an estimate that the merchandise sale alone accounts for $66 million for the Eras tour in Australia. And if you look at eBay, you look at Facebook Marketplace, you can see a lot of resale activities already happening, and where, you know, fans exchanging merchandise, or a lot of them actually jack up the prices of this merchandise.
Yeah, wow.
That is a huge amount of money. And speaking of the, you know, these massive figures and what we're calling a boost, I'm, you know, a bit shocking at economy. As much as I would have liked to have taken economics at school, I didn't. Are we to expect a return to what we'd call normal, or a drop once everybody leaves, once there's a cool down from Taylor Swift, or will it continue to ride this sort of high of the economy?
Really good question there. The economic benefit of such a large but one-off events are always just limited to the immediate area of the event, and usually it is only for short term. I mean, the other question I've been asked of quite a lot is that would the Eras tour cause an uptick in inflation? Which I would really say no, because this is just a one-off event, and a lot of office spending has already occurred last year when fans started to book their travel, which is why I don't think this will create a long-term impact on the economy.
Okay, yeah, and I mean that makes sense. A little bit sad, but no, that makes sense. So we've heard a lot about people losing money to scammers who are trying to sell tickets, which is quite sad. My grandma actually went to a scammers course, how to avoid them, which I thought was perfect timing. And there was an article in the ABC that said potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars have been lost to scammers offering fake tickets. Does that impact Australian economy at all, or is that a very separate field?
I think that's a separate field, and you're right. It also depends on whether what scammers are located in or out of Australia. Of course, if the scammers are outside of Australia, then it is a direct deduction from our economy. So it depends on the location of the scammers. But I don't think that is a mainstream it doesn't happen extensively in this Eras tour.
Okay, yeah. Declan?
So will there be an economic drop after this? And also, how does it work when there is a temporary boom in economy with tourism and people flocking to one or two major cities?
Yes, will there be a drop? I don't think there will be a significant drop because, remember, we are in a course of living crisis. We have several interest rate hikes. A lot of people are just grappling with the rising cost of living, that begs the question why Swifties are able to spend so much. So I actually find that there is a substitution effect there in the economy, which means a lot of Swifties are actually making financial sacrifices, so they are actually substituting expenses in other areas. So for example, a very simple example, you can buy cheaper tomato sauce by buying home brand, but you can't really buy a home brand Eras tour ticket, right? And that is that's what the Australian Bureau of Statistics found over the last few months. Australians, not just for the Eras tour, among Australians, recreation spending has consistently shown resilience within household budgets, even though there's a cost of living crisis. But it seems like Australians are cutting back on expenditure in other areas so that they still get they can enjoy themselves. For example, last year we have the FIFA Women's World Cup as well. That's where Australians spend a lot of money on. So we're talking about a substitution effect. So people have to cut back on other areas to spend on cultural experience. So they tend to offset each other, which is why I don't think it will create a dramatic impact there.
Yeah, well, it's quite touching to hear that people do love her so much that they do want to cut back in other areas, but also it's hard to hear and it'd be hard to do. We'll leave it there. Thank you so much for talking to us today. It's made my brain less concerned about how much money was suddenly coming in. And thank you for sparing the time. I hope that one day soon, maybe with this new album coming out, you will get to see her live.
Thanks so much for having me today.
Thank you, Angel.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Angel.
Thank you.
You're listening to Sin. We're back. You're listening to Represent with Naya, Declan and Casper, and we just finished an interview with Professor Angel Zhong on the economy and Taylor Swift. Now we're going to chat somewhat more at what I'd say is in our lane for the show. We have Dr. Catherine Strong, an associate professor in the music industry program at RMIT, same building we're in, to talk about politics and the music industry. So tell us a bit about what you do first.
So I'm a sociologist. I did my PhD in sociology. But the thing I've ended up studying a lot is popular music and the popular music industry here in Australia. So I've done a lot of work on gender and popular music and music as a workplace as well. So looking at work conditions and how people get jobs, what it's like to work in the music industry, those sorts of things. And all of those things have a bit of a political element to them, I think. Yeah. I always have to think about politics and policies and whether there's money around to support the music industries, that sort of stuff. So
yeah. That's fascinating. I think especially at a time like this where workplace cultures are becoming more public and how they run, we hear about it a lot. We'll jump straight into quote-unquote politics as we know it with governments, that sort of thing, but we will jump all over the place. Someone like Taylor Swift, who I think everyone's going to be taking count of how many times we say her name today, what kind of influence does someone like that have over elections and political process?
I think celebrities have quite a bit of influence in the political sphere at the moment. I think we've seen with the Taylor Swift tour that the amount of attention that she got was absolutely phenomenal. Like, it was next level. Like, there are celebrities and then there is someone like Taylor Swift who has just taken it to a whole new level where you couldn't turn on the television, look at a news channel, look at a newspaper, like
social media
a news site.
Was flooded.
Absolutely flooded. So, and I think what we saw as well, which was really interesting, was just everybody trying to find a way to tie whatever their thing is in with the Taylor Swift thing. So I saw a post the other day from another university where they were talking about Taylor Swift loves to drink a cup of tea, and so let's talk to our expert on tea about tea drinking. And it's like, wow, that is
extraordinary.
But I think as well, we've seen it in academia that we had there was the Taylor Swift conference last week. So which isn't to say, of course, like a lot of academics study things to do with people like Taylor Swift anyway, but just the amount of attention that event got because it was Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
So there are lots of other like really interesting academic conferences, but the fact that it had the Swift name next to it meant that it was like international attention for that in the media. So to come back to the actual question, I think that when somebody has that level of attention put on them, anything that they then say that is political or could even be interpreted as being political is going to have a lot of people then, of course, paying attention to that, and could potentially be extremely controversial depending on what they say, could really drive a lot of people's interest in an issue. So if Taylor Swift was to talk about, well, she has talked about things like LGBTQI rights. She has spoken up about elections in the United States. definitely seems as though she skews towards sort of the left side of politics. She gave support to Democratic candidates in some of the elections over there. And so that can be a real boost for people on that side of politics. And the other thing that happens, of course, is that if she shows her colours and says, I am in support of this side of politics, then the other side of politics has to try and deal with that. And we've seen some very interesting things going on in the States where the way they're trying to deal with that is by creating conspiracy theories where they are trying to argue that Taylor Swift is a deep state plant and that her relationship with Travis Kelce, it's Travis Kelce, isn't it?
Yeah.
Isn't star, real. Yep. And that the whole thing is just a big conspiracy that is about trying to, I'm not exactly sure what they think it's trying to do. It's trying to get Biden reelected and it's going to be terrible for the country and people are being hoodwinked into thinking that this is a real thing when it's a whole big, you know, stage production. So fascinating to watch.
Does this conspiracy theory, sensationalism, does it bite? Does it work?
It does work with some people, yeah. I think I saw a study a couple of days ago that said there was like a fifth of people in the United States, they'd done a poll, a fifth of people did believe that this conspiracy theory was true.
Wow.
So there is, at the moment, you know, as we all know, there is a lot of misinformation that is out there that flows through sort of social media, and people are increasingly talking about the way that people are really in bubbles when it comes to their online presence. They sort of get into a situation where they are talking to and interacting with other people who are like-minded, and it means that where those conspiracy theories can take hold are in some of those bubbles. People will then sort of repeat it to each other, reinforce each other's belief in it. So it really can take hold among, you know, people who are already inclined to believe those sorts of things.
Do we then see, if we sort of flip it around the other way, for someone as big as Taylor Swift, because, of course, there's such a spectrum between where she is now and even where she started, of how popular and how public you are, does it have effects on her commercial success, or would it have effects on a lesser known artist's commercial success should they raise political views?
It definitely can have effects on people. There have been instances where artists have said political things and had quite... It had big impacts on their career. So, I mean, the Dixie Chicks is the most famous example of that. So that was a country band that said some negative things about President Bush when he was invading Iraq or Afghanistan, well, one of those wars. And the result was that their fan base sort of turned on them and there was, like, burning of their albums and running them over with tractors and stuff like that.
Yeah.
The thing about that, though, is that they went against sort of type in a way. So country music artists, you know, there is a tendency for them to have a fan base that is a little bit more on the right, more tending towards, you know, voting Republican over in the States or being a bit more right wing. So it means that by coming out against the sort of prevailing beliefs of the fan base that they had, they then had this like backlash. So it's not to say that all, like, I'm definitely not saying all people who listen to country music are right wing, right?
Yeah.
But it does sort of skew a bit that way. Whereas Taylor Swift, when she has been saying political things, I think that what has happened is it has been things that have been more in line with what she understands her fan base to be thinking in the first place,
yeah,
right?
Okay.
So her saying, I support LGBTQI rights, is like, well, her fan base is like, well, why would you do anything else? Like, there was no clash there between the main sort of vibe in her fan base and the things that she was saying. So it sort of comes together more easily when it's that sort of situation.
I've seen reports that some people have considered what Taylor Swift's been saying so for a long time she was apolitical or tended not to say anything politically. I think she claimed when she was younger that it was because she didn't know enough or she didn't want to have an opinion, which is like quite common for people in the public eye to say. When she started to say things on, for example, LGBTQ rights, people have come out and criticised her for being, maybe it was tokenistic or, in fact, maybe disingenuous. Do you feel like these people have a responsibility to, like, do more, would you say? Or how do you feel about sort of these people in the public eye is it disingenuous when she does just agree with what her fans say? I guess that's like a bit of an open question.
Yeah, that's a good question, yes. And she definitely has been criticised along those lines as well. Like, being in support of LGBTQI rights these days is like, you know, it's weird not to. For the vast majority of public figures, it would be seen as extremely controversial and weird to come out and be anti those rights. Okay, so it's a real fringe position. So yes, that is a no-brainer of a position for her to come out with. And the question of whether she should be doing more, I mean, you know, but personally, I would love to see her go further and actually take some positions that are a bit more solid. Would love to have her, would really love to see her in particular, substantively address the criticisms that have been sent her way around things like her use of her private jet. And, you know, I'm not here to say Taylor Swift should never use a private jet, right? Look, I don't think private jets should exist, but that's another matter.
Yeah.
Right, so we're not sort of going to say, well, Taylor Swift is the cause of the climate crisis or anything like that. But she has been sort of put in a position where people are asking questions about what she's doing in that space. And for her to then come out and make a stance and to sort of say some solid things about, actually, you know, this is a problem. What are we going to do about it? What are we going to do about it collectively? I think it would look like not only sort of be a way of starting to circumvent those criticisms that are being directed at her, but it might sort of help the whole public discourse around what we're going to do about what's happening to the planet. It might move the whole thing further and quicker than it would do otherwise. So, you know, I think there is like an ethical question that we could be asking of people who are in these positions of power that these celebrities are in, to say, like, is there like a moral imperative? You know, you could make a difference on this particular issue. Why are you not doing that? And I think, again, like, one of the interesting things with someone like Taylor Swift is she does seem very responsive to her fans, and she talks a lot about how much she loves her fans and how she listens to her fans and those sorts of things. I think that there is like a potential here for the fandom to actually have the power, and for them to be sort of organizing amongst themselves and saying, like, yeah, you know, let's send this message back to Taylor. What are you going to do about this particular thing? You know, are you going to get rid of the private jet, or are you going to like start making some really big contributions to funds that help do something about climate change? You know, I know there's like a lot of Swifties around the place who are like, you know, there's also this parrot in Tasmania that's about to go extinct called the Swift parrot. And it's like, whoa, like what a PR amazing campaign that would be. Like, Taylor Swift saves the Swift parrot from extinction by getting out there and like getting support for this thing and stopping the Tasmanian government from knocking down all the trees or whatever they're doing. She could be doing more, right? And it could be really fun for her to do more, and there are ways in which it could happen that, you know, the fans can get behind. Yeah. Yes. So to cut a long story short, I think we should be asking questions of our celebrities. Like, we should be recognising the power they have and asking questions of them about what they could be doing to just make the world a better place. And they have the ability to do that.
Yeah, so like, speaking of outrageous conspiracy theories that one person can spark in response to their public opinions, can one person like Taylor Swift cause outrage and generalizations about the music industry as a whole body?
Yeah, that's a good question. So one of the responses sometimes when people do make political statements is that you will often see people turn around and say, well, you are just a musician. You should just play your music and shut up and not talk about anything else. Like, it's very common. And, you know, usually coming from people who disagree with what the person says, the people who agree with what they say are like, yeah, you know, say more of that. So, you know, should people just stay in their lane and not do anything other than what they're known for? I think that that's sort of asking musicians to be not human in a way. Like, you know, they're always going to have opinions about things. I think sort of asking them to have this like really firm line between their art and the rest of their life and the rest of the things that they think about the world is unrealistic. They, you know, do have to think carefully about what they say, and they're always going to have a PR team around them that is going to be workshopping what they should and shouldn't say as well. So the idea that they're ever just giving a spontaneous thought off the top of their head. I mean, they do sometimes, but often it's much more carefully managed than that. But yeah, I mean, one of the reasons why we connect with musicians is because often there is something about them as a person that comes through their music, and that's what we respond to in music. It's you know, we feel like we have some sort of, on some level, some personal connection with these people. And I think that that can be deepened if we know more about the person and what, where they stand on particular issues and all the rest of it, which, you know, if they decide that they want to be private about those things, that's completely up to them. But I think criticizing them because they speak about the world is also pretty unfair.
Absolutely. If we, we've been talking very specifically about Taylor Swift, if we move to a very big, springboarding off some theories that I've heard and I've tried to validate but haven't worked out, so I won't name them specifically, but Taylor Swift's tour, other than Australia, where she only came to Sydney and Melbourne and the rest of the country went, what? Why aren't you coming to the rest of us? She's gone to very specific countries. She only visited Tokyo in Asia, which some people have said was quite unusual. I've got to make sure I word this correctly. Can political relationships between countries and parts of the world influence the global music movement market? It's a bit of a convoluted question. Say tensions were between a country and the USA, would it be feasible and tenable for an artist like Taylor Swift from the US to perform in those countries?
Oh, yes. That's a really hot topic, isn't it? Great question. Yes, I mean, there's often pressure on artists to not go to some places. Like, so at the moment, a lot of artists are getting a lot of pressure on them not to go to Israel, for instance. I imagine that there are a lot of artists that if they went and played in Russia at the moment, a lot of eyebrows would be... Like, if Taylor Swift had gone and played in Moscow, right, what would people have said about that? Or if she'd gone to play in Tel Aviv, right?
True.
So I have seen, you know, some tweets about, you know, there was speculation that she would go to Tel Aviv at one point, and straight away there was, like, a lot of people being like, you can't do that, right? That is a really controversial place for people to go. A lot of people are boycotting Israel because of what they're doing in Palestine at the moment. So, yes, I mean, this plays out along geopolitical lines, this question about, you know, what artists should and shouldn't do. Again, you know, sort of... putting artists in this really interesting position where they're making these decisions that, like, when they decide where they're going to tour, it's fundamentally a commercial decision, right? They're thinking about where they're going to sell tickets, how they, like, where it is feasible for them to go, what the balance is between, with something like this tour, you've got this massive stage set up, you've got this huge crew. If you try and go to literally every city in Australia and every country town, at some point you're going to lose money because you're hauling all that stuff around and it costs money to set it up and you've got so many, you know, people working for you. So they're making commercial decisions all the time. And part of that is, as well, I could go to Moscow, probably sell out a bunch of shows, but what would the blowback from that be? Would it ultimately be commercially bad for me because people would be so outraged that I had gone to play in Russia at this point in time, as opposed to, you know, am I gaining new audiences in a place like that? And also, I mean, there another thing that people talk about sometimes is this idea that, you know, music can be something that actually helps to heal, I mean, you know, to put it in a bit of a trite way, heal wounds or bring people together, right? That music is something that can break down barriers between people. And, you know, it doesn't matter if you're a Russian or an American, if you love Taylor Swift, then you love Taylor Swift and you have something in common, and maybe that's something that can build connections between people. And that's something that's worth considering as well. Like, I mean, I don't ever want to be the person who has to make decisions about whether or not you go to places like that, because it would be really hard to make. Yeah. Yeah.
Historically, there's also probably some, like, if you think of the Cold War and music being played in Moscow post the fall of the Berlin Wall, and that's probably some similar sort of political elements to that as well, definitely. So I guess Taylor Swift and other artists have definitely got to think about that.
Well, speaking of sort of going over time, have we seen, and I don't know whether this is put down to social media or if there is even a reason or if there's been change, have we seen the relationship between politics and artists and musicians change over the last 20, 40, 60, 100 years?
It's something that's always evolving. I think at the moment we're seeing some really strange lines being drawn in terms of where artists are saying they sit on a whole bunch of different issues, and it's causing, like, there is, like, it's sort of, it feels like there's, like, ongoing, constant sort of outrage and controversy because some artist or another has come out and said they think something about vaccines, or they think something about some of the wars that are going on, or they think something about, just some aspect of internal politics from wherever it is they are from. And some of these things are playing out in unexpected ways. So I think that there was, like, a period of time where you would expect, a certain type of rock musician or indie artist to sort of consistently fall within a particular range of political views that, again, would be sort of fairly left, fairly progressive sort of leaning. And a lot of that stuff just isn't the case anymore. We're seeing sort of some of those rockers from the 60s getting older and becoming much more right-wing and saying things that seem strange and out of tune with what they said when they were younger. And that's really fascinating to watch. But also just that, it does feel like the whole political landscape is so fraught and so, difficult to navigate.
Absolutely.
At the moment. There's also been, I'll just chuck in as a last sort of thing, that the Me Too movement has also created a lot of fractures in terms of where people are sort of seen to sit within music. And this question about sort of cancelling people, what does that mean? When do you do that? What do people have to have done to sort of be seen to be so problematic that you, for instance, wouldn't listen to their music again, or you would chuck all their stuff in the bin? It's like, there have been some artists who have done terrible things to people. Do you then throw all their stuff away? Or if they just disagree with you on a political level, is that something that then might lead you to not want to listen to their music anymore? So I think, like, audiences and fans are in a situation where they're constantly having to ask themselves these questions and sort of renegotiate where they sit in relation to a whole bunch of artists. The more artists talk about what they think about things, the more likely it is you're going to be in a position where you're like, I actually really don't agree with that person about something. So then what does that mean for how you relate to the music?
Yeah, absolutely. We don't want to take up any more of your time, but before we go, got two very quick questions. First one is, I've been watching, and we've talked about this a lot on the show, Nemesis, ABC, so I'm going to play the game that they've played. Have you seen it?
I haven't.
Okay, well, that's good. Then you'll have no idea what I'm talking about. What is the first word that springs to mind when I say Taylor Swift?
Bracelets.
Oh, I love that.
We've actually, Naya's made everyone in the studio represent friendship by bracelet.
I'm wearing mine. I will be wearing it with pride. I have also a bunch that my PhD students made for me as well, which I'm also going to be treasuring forever. I love the bracelets. I think the bracelets are just such a beautiful little lovely thing that the fandom does.
Oh, yeah. Totally with you on that. And the other quick question is, what is your favourite Taylor Swift song?
It's Bad Blood.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. That is a good one. I like that a lot. Thank you so much for joining us today. My eyes have been opened and now I'm really curious about a couple of things and where music has come into the world. And I would love to see if artists do go and play in places like Russia during today's political climate. So thank you so much for being in the studio, and hopefully we'll get to chat to you again soon when the next massive artist comes into the country.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you.
You're listening to Sin.
Welcome to Your News Here. I'm Declan Evans from the newsroom. WA John Quigley has announced plans to stand down as Attorney General and MP for Butler. Opposition leader Peter Dutton has accused Labor of cutting funding for border protection, linking this to the mainland arrival at 39 asylum seekers. Claire O'Neill accuses Peter Dutton of telling easily disapprovable lies over border force funding. And Tasmania's unique electoral system means all bets are off on whether the Liberals will continue to hold the only state that is not held by Labor. And Nationals Deputy Leader Peter Perrindavi reveals a health issue behind apparent slurring in the Senate two times. She said her apparent slurring was the result of two emergency operations and an 11-day stint in hospital after an abscess erupted behind her tonsils in 2019. The incident had left her with ongoing speech challenges, she said. The Nationalist Party has hit back at renewed calls for alcohol breath testing in Parliament, saying they've been using breathalysers. Woolworths CEO has left and resigned 2 days after walking out on his Four Corners interview, and Taylor Swift's jet with Travis Kelce on board arrived in Sydney, Australia, and met with Taylor Swift ahead of her four sold-out shows this weekend, and Victoria Police released a social media post quoting, they knew that Taylor Swift crowds weren't going to be trouble when they walked in, and over the 3 nights and almost 300,000 fans of the star in attendance, they made no rest. This is my news hit.
Welcome back, everyone. That was Hear Hair by Gustav. Today, also, we've had a great chat about Taylor Swift earlier with two great interviews, and now we're going to jump into the topic of the recent music festival cancellations and the issues that that venues are facing across Victoria and Australia. Groovin' in the Moo was the most recent festival to be cancelled among others across the 2023 and 2024 season, and it signals a growing difficulty for live music. The Greens have then now called, or the Australian Greens, and spokesperson for the arts, Sarah Hanson-Young, she has written to the Minister for the Arts, Tony Burke, and has asked for a festival support package to ensure that the music festivals can stay viable. And additionally, across music across Victoria, there's other venues that are facing increasing public liability and insurance costs, and this is affecting their businesses. Now, on the show today, we're going to have an interview guest from Music Victoria. Music Victoria have just released their Perceptions of Live Music Insights from Young Victorians report. It came out on Wednesday, and it's investigating both the issues of why these cancellations might be happening and the way that young people are perceiving live music. The study surveyed 500 young people between 16 and 35, and it's focusing specifically on how they see the current live music scene. So welcome to the show, CEO for Music Victoria, Simone Schinkel. How are you doing today?
Good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on. Now, I'd just like to ask you to start off. What does Music Victoria do, and what's your role at Music Victoria?
Yeah, so Music Victoria is the peak body for music in the state. We're all about music and its viability and sustainability in Victoria. So we're a membership-based organisation, and we're there for artists, DJs, musicians, crew, venues, festivals, recording studios, rehearsal studios, music media, the list goes on. Anything that kind of intersects with Victorian music. We're striving towards, you know, keeping that live music capital of the world going and bubbling and getting everyone out there to enjoy it.
Yeah, amazing. Wow. So this report that you've released on Wednesday, 500 young people surveyed between 16 and 35. Talk to us about conducting this report and some of the key findings that have come out of it.
Yeah, well, look, we were having conversations with our members, some of those festival members and venue members who were kind of looking around in their audiences and going, is there less young people than normally? And so it's just a sort of trend that we wanted to dive deep in to really see if that was just, you know, an observation that whether it's true or not, or whether we're just reading the room incorrectly. But what we found is that, look, young people are really keen to engage with music and live music events, but the challenges really are affordability and motivation. So there was a report that came out of the UK which looked at a similar kind of demographic and was seeing this drop in young people's engagement, but obviously we want to know what's happening right here in our own backyard rather than on the other side of the world.
Yeah, of course. And
And the other thing that we found that was really exciting is actually how important that first live music experience is. So 78% of young people just emphasised how that first moment really got them hooked and actually shaped their overall passion for music that's continued throughout their lives.
Yeah, I'd love to know a little bit more about that first moment. So you said 78%. What about that first gig is so formative?
Ah, well, have you been? Because I know what it's like for
yeah,
me.
Yeah, I have been, yeah.
Looking back, it's a real moment of self-identity. I think sometimes it's about finding your people, it's about independence and really discovering your place and understanding of the world and how you want to move through it. So sharing those moments with 500 others or 5,000 others, depending what sort of show you're going to, can be a really special moment. And so, yeah, just having that differentiation from, you know, you've heard the track being played on the radio or you've heard it in your bedroom. This is that moment where you feel it come alive and you can see the sweats and the tears and, you know, you're in it together.
Yeah.
Really powerful stuff. I get goosebumps talking about it.
True. I think I can think back and think of the first festival that I actually went to and think seeing all these artists that I'd definitely wanted to pay for it was like that was a big deal for me.
I'm quite shameful. I don't think I've been to a music festival. Maybe it's my fear of crowds.
You'll
but
have
no,
to go to
I
it.
Know. You'll have to get some recommendations.
Now, Simone.
No, well, look, that's something else that we actually found. So the festival market seemed to be quite resilient for 19 to 22-year-olds, but there's a real drop-off for those aged 16 to 18. And I think it's important to acknowledge that we have had a pandemic and 3 years of lockdowns and those changing consumer behaviours, and what we want out of life and live music spaces and experience has changed. And perhaps you just missed it when it might have usually occurred with a coming of age during a pandemic. So that's something that we hope to highlight with this sort of research, is to go, okay, we acknowledge we missed 3 years of a core moment in your life in engaging with live music, but let's make that happen for you now.
Now, you did say that's a good point between the 16 to 18-year-olds and that COVID missing the first exposure. Now, as you mentioned, there was a drop-off at that age level. That's probably the most concerning thing. A lot of SYN listeners are actually young people. That's what we're here for. And I've read that 10% lower than expected. So 52% historically went to a big festival before they'd, or a big or small festival before they were 18 years old. And now it's roughly 10% lower for both small and big festivals. Why is it the under 18s, and what can we do about under 18s in particular?
Well, look, there's another part that adds on to exactly those figures you've just repeated, which is that 11% of 16 to 18-year-olds at the moment don't even think about going to see live music. And when we compare that to the 19 to 35-year-olds, they're at just 8%. So there's also some worrying stats in that, going, we're just not front of mind anymore, because I think we've got out of the habit of going and seeing live music while there was a pandemic. We've also can't take music out of the broader economic world and climate. And I think some of the statements that were generated from participants in barriers to attendance is that I'm trying to reduce my spending to only essentials at the moment. You know, music is a want, it's seen as a want, not a need. And other comments were, I have less disposable income to spend on tickets, reported by 67%, and live music feels expensive compared to other forms of entertainment. But then on the flip side, we've still got 57% who are still happily buying tickets. So we might know it's not the best way to spend our money if we can't pay rent, but hell, we still want to go out for a good time. So some of us are still doing it.
Yeah.
Can I jump in and ask a question which may sound completely dumb? But when you're talking about going to see live music, what events are you talking about specifically? Because I've just got to address the elephant in the room, which is all those young people who filled the MCG over the last weekend. And that was quite unusual that many sort of tweens and preteens wanting to see one artist. So what would you, because I mean a festival is different to one person standing on a stage, where does the live music spread sit, especially by Music Victoria? Where does this study talk about music?
Yeah, so we're capturing all of it, really. So we look at local venues, which are probably under 500 capacities. There's some that can be as small as 50 to 100. Then we've got some mid-sized venues. Then we've got large kind of stadium venues. We've also done some research and separated out by dance venues, just like a nightclub or more of an electronic scene. So, yeah, we've also got small festivals, which are under 5,000 capacity, and then large festivals which are over a 5,000 capacity audience. So we've really tried to look at the whole gamut of the ecology. And look, I think what's, you know, I know everyone's banging on about Taylor Swift, but look, I'm actually really excited. Like, the opportunity for 12-year-olds to go and see live music are actually few and far between. We've started getting better at having family-friendly options, and often the local councils will do some great free show festivals that, you know, encourage all ages to get involved. But when we just go a little bit further up, you want to be slightly cooler than going, you know, just with mum and dad, and want to go with your friends and maybe someone to chaperone you. But it's that sort of stuff like Taylor Swift that I think could be a great entry point. I think we've got a lot of work as an industry to do on a few more all-ages gigs. I know that's how I first got hooked. So I'd still be in a traditional live music venue or a bowls club, but it just wouldn't have the alcohol for sale. And yeah, I was just there enjoying it like the adults did, but in the afternoon.
Yeah, true. Now, Simone, with that issue of, like, Taylor Swift, for example, is a massive artist, and she's been offering this, something that young people can also go to, so under 18. Something that's affecting the music industry, which I tended to read in the report, was that it's multi-genre. International artists and sort of specific artists are still thriving, and also are genre-specific festivals. For multi-genre festivals that maybe also target young people as well, or under 18s, how, speaking of some solutions to these issues now, how would you go about addressing or redirecting funding to get towards these festivals that still need support, even the underage ones?
Yeah, look, the Victorian government made some really great election commitments that we're still waiting to be rolled out. So in that, one of them was festivals funding. So I think there's a true commitment to maintaining what is happening in Victoria in that festival scene. So, you know, can't come soon enough is kind of where we're at now. And look, some of these operators have had a really hard 3 years of going ahead, not going ahead due to COVID, starting again, or using up all their, you know, bank money that's in the bank, all their reserves. So they just don't have the same capacity to put on a big show and take a big risk when audience ticket buying behaviours have also changed and they're very last minute. So it's not that we want to put anyone to fault, but it is a really big complex combination of factors that we really need to pull apart and as an industry kind of share that load of trying to solve it. So, you know, we call on audiences to make those commitments earlier and to get really excited about going so that the festivals and the artists can know that it's going to be a viable option and tour for them. But at the same time, I think we could do some first-timer tickets. One of the other challenges was just having insufficient energy or public transport options. So things like that are easy solves. We can absolutely arrange transport to and from gigs and, you know, make that really straightforward and sell that as part of the ticketing deal as opposed to something the individual has to work out by themselves.
Yeah, of course. And do you think that what the Australian Greens have called for, so this support package, if they were to be addressed with some of the, if this funding or extra money were to be addressed and do these easy solutions, as you've said, or the things that you could do immediately, would that be enough, or what else needs to be done?
I think we need to evolve. I think there's often a desire, I guess, to throw money at the problem, make it go away, but that just doesn't actually address some of the changing consumer habits and appetites. One of the challenges that I think is actually very relevant to this conversation and this research is the lack of knowledge about Australian acts and how hard it is to discover them and to hear them and to listen to them. So while Taylor's everywhere, we've got great talent, but it's just not found on our airwaves in ways it used to be. And the way the algorithms work are working against local content. So there's some bigger challenges sitting alongside call for festival funding, sure, but until we get an audience demand as well for those local Australian acts, or even better, Victorian, from my point of view, then it's going to be a real hard shift, because trying to cover the cost of bringing artists internationally over to Australia is just going to get harder and harder.
Yeah, of course. And as you speak about evolving, some of the issues that sort of, and our Australian sort of festivals that have often thrived before,
some of the issues that festivals are facing, for example, Groovin' the Moo, maybe not Groovin' in the Moo, but we've seen last year with the extreme weather conditions and high public liability insurance costs. How do we address these issues when the climate's changing and also the circumstances are not as secure as they have been before?
Yeah, I think we need to give ourselves a serious look into what our processes are in terms of how are we addressing the challenges that we face with the climate, because flying people over internationally probably isn't the most sustainable way to keep moving forward. And as an industry, we do a lot of travel, and that's not ideal when we're trying to address some of these bigger challenges. In terms of... Sorry, I lost my train of thought. You were talking about, the insurance challenges. Absolutely. Lots of the approaches we've been taking with our members has been a kind of long-term approach of risk mitigation, educating insurers, educating brokers, educating our own venues to give up-to-date data, share also the fact that actually the next generation isn't drinking as much alcohol, which really subsidised a lot of the music industry for quite a long time. So we have to change those models. And now it's probably you need a restaurant to sit alongside your band room, really, to keep that going. So some of those things, you know, we can cry and say goodbye to what we miss, but we also need to look to the future and go, well, what is possible and what is this new way of consuming and enjoying? Because there's still something inherently fundamental and exciting and worthwhile doing in engaging with live music. But again, if it needs to be outdoors in winter instead of, you know, fire season, then that's something we really have to look into.
Yeah, of course.
Just jumping in, when you look at, say, I think were you saying, so under 5,000 is considered small?
Festivals, yes.
Yeah. Have you found, because instinctively I'd think, so the bigger ones above 5,000 would receive a lot of energy and publicity. But do you find that, say, those smaller ones perhaps run by local councils, is there good traction by local councils versus, say, state governments? Is there any difference, or do they both really need to work on making sure that there's funding there?
Yeah, I think there's funding contributed at all levels. I know across the broader arts landscape, local councils have really stepped up, and it's almost a third split between feds, local and state government, and it didn't used to be the way. It used to be more federal and state and not so much on the local point. But these small festivals, the numbers and the way they actually work has been without funding for so long. So I think that's also really exciting and something that I think we can be proud of commercially as an industry. And it's these moments now after a pandemic where there's a multitude of challenges that we do turn to the government for a bit of support, but it's really this making sure it's fundamentally changing our businesses to be stronger and more sustainable in the future. No one wants a band-aid solution that actually just delays the problem for another year. We actually need when we call for money, what we're calling for is time, essentially. Just help us through this bit while we let all the other initiatives that we're driving to create change take effect, because some things just take time, and particularly on this insurance front, that's the biggest challenge, is that we've just reached this tipping point where venues can no longer afford to pay these exorbitant costs, and all the strategies that we have in place for reducing risk and education and training don't happen overnight, and even the positive benefits aren't appreciated by brokers and insurances firms until they've been in action, and you can prove it with a tale of a good couple of years under your belt.
Yeah, wow. Yeah, it seems that you've got a good plan in place, and it's just that time that's the important part. I wanted to ask as well, what do young people themselves, how can they react to this news and this report that you've released, and sort of, or how should they react, and what action must be taken from us?
Look, I'm just excited that they still love live music, but I want them to know that we acknowledge that times are tough, and this is not on you to solve that problem either, but we're going to try and make it easier for you to get out and about, make it more affordable, provide public transport options so that it is as easy as possible. I guess my heartstrings would probably be requesting that you really try and look out for local talent, because you'd be amazed at how great the talent is just around the corner. Music Victoria's got a whole bunch of playlists on the leading streaming platform that you can tap into. But yeah, really great local talent that, you know, deserves our time and energy. And although it might not be handed to you quite as easily on social media platforms with all the algorithms working against us, you do have to do that little bit of work. But let me tell you, it'll pay off in spades when you can just go down the corner and see them live.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Simone. I definitely will be going out and seeing some live music.
So much free stuff as well. So make sure you engage with what's out there in these tough times and then pay it back when you can.
Perfect. Thank you, Simone Schinkel, Music CEO of Victoria. Music Victoria, pardon me.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Synth. We're back. You're listening to Represent on Sin. That was Beg by Vero and Human by Floodlights.
Quick shout out to the Floodlights. Woo!
Woohoo! Yes, I definitely
did. Very happy when that song came on.
Woohoo! Yes, we did. We turned it up in the studio. Casper danced.
Yeah.
I'm going to start spreading fake news about you. All right, so the segment that we tentatively started last week, we actually have a jar which will be put onto the socials, so, you know, we're not lying when we pick countries out of it. We are doing our what's on, oh no, not what's on, what's happening in the world. And as per last week, I was to talk about the Philippines, and it's quite generally, it's talking about their political system and if anything, you know, big is happening. I'm looking forward to the day that one of us gets the US. That'll be a whole show.
Yeah.
And I know Australia's in there too, so I did pop a little note for the person who picks out Australia. So maybe we'll see that this year. Hopefully, I'd love to get through them in a year. But the most basic fact, the Philippines is a country in Asia. Correct. It is about 9 hours flight away from Melbourne, or the ad that came up said 8.5 hours, so I'm flying with them. And the official languages are Filipino and English. According to World Bank, it has a population of 113.9 million people as of 2021. It overtook Vietnam around 2000 and has been getting closer to Japan's population, with a population growing consistently for about the last 60 years. It is a democratic nation and has what is referred to as a three-branch system of government. They have a president, currently that is Bongbong Marcos Jr., who has been elected by the people democratically. He is the leader of the executive branch of government. Then they have a bicameral Congress, which has Senate, House of Reps. Very familiar, very familiar. Elections are held every 3 years and senators are on a six-year term. Also, very familiar. I had to check that it was the correct country I was looking at.
Quick question.
Yes.
What does bicameral mean?
Two houses.
Two houses, just like Australia. Two.
Yeah, just like Australia, just like the US, I think. Yeah, they do have two. Yeah. So, yeah, very, very, very similar. According to the site, and I shout out to this site's name, factsanddetails.com.
They got in early.
Love it. Absolutely love it. So according to them, there has been a long-term trend of political dynasties and politicians coming from the same bloodlines, which whilst we don't see that necessarily in Australia, I think you often find, especially in old politics, there's a trend of people will often go to the same private schools. Definitely old politics. We see much more diversity across politics now, but, you know, you used to be able to see, you know, there were three or four private schools and that was where most politicians would have gone to and grown up. And so whilst that doesn't mean they're all coming from the same family, it's the same quote-unquote echelon of society. So we can sort of see that. But yeah, I thought that was very interesting. They have operated since 1935 on three different constitutions, not at the same time. And the first one was during a period of American administration and thus has been modelled on the US Constitution. Now, what I found most interesting was, and kind of confusing, forgive me if I get any of this wrong, because I was trying to, we've got two names that are essentially the same, and that is very confusing for me. So between 1972 and 81, the Philippines operated under a martial law under the President Ferdinand E. Marcos. They're currently under President Bongbong Marcos Jr. So, same name. But according to Mong Palatino, writing for The Diplomat, the UN has noted the need for legal reforms since the Marcos, not Marcos Jr., administration. So, there's not huge amounts in the news right now about the Philippines, but I thought it was interesting that they came out of martial law in 81, and it's been 43 years, and now they're calling for more legal reform since that.
Do you think it could leadership. Also have something probably to do with the way that, yeah, the same bloodline politicians?
Yeah.
I'm not sure about the inequality rates in the Philippines, but I think that possibly, yeah, the martial law and now the UN noting the need for legal reforms. I wonder what Marcos Jr. has to say about that as well. Yeah,
and because they don't, by the sounds of it, they don't inherit, because I was trying to work this out. And listeners, tweet us or send us a message on any of our socials at SinRepresent if you know. But it looks like you don't inherit your seat. You're still voted in. It's still democratic. You're democratically voted in. But it is that same families are usually in the parliament, and there are some significant families whose names were listed on, again, my favourite website, Facts and Details.
Philippines is also one of the countries not to have an election this year. It'll be next year.
They're missing out.
Missing out on all the goss.
It'll make them more popular next year.
Yeah, there'll be more focus on that.
We have federal next year.
We have federal.
We're running on exactly the same 3-year cycle as them. Oh, that makes me happy. Don't know why, but, you know, twinning.
They also had one in 2022 as well.
Oh, look at us go.
So sticking to that 3-year cycle just like us.
Which is, it's interesting. And I don't know why I'm always, this sounds like a terrible thing. I'm always surprised when I read that a country is democratic because we hear so much about, you know, the death of democracy. And every time I see that a country is democratic, I'm like, what? No way. And it's never a judgment on the country itself. It's just, no way.
See, I go the other way. I get surprised when things aren't democratic.
Yeah, okay. I feel like I used to be like that. And then I started, you know, this seed of doubt. Don't know where it's come from. Hope it goes away.
Now, I would say we should do Spain, but we might leave that one for next week.
I think so. But what we do need to do is, I don't know if you can hear this, this is our little jar for next week. So we will talk about Spain, but I think we're going to fit in another one.
So we'll do two next week, one of which is Spain. Now, Naya, do you want to do the honours?
I will, but I'm going to make sure that I film this for the socials so I'm not lying. Let's get this. All right. Yeah, dipping in, featuring the ears to a bracelet. All right, the country for next week, please not be Spain or the Philippines because I did forget to take them out, is New Guinea.
Ooh.
All right, you will hear about that next week. Now, closing the video, popping that, doing the admin while on air. So it's, almost dinner time. Do you know what you're doing for dinner?
No, do I know yet?
Neither. No idea. Running around. Thanks for tuning in to Represent on Sin. Let us know what you thought of the show on our socials. We're on Twitter/X, take your pick, and Instagram and technically Facebook and apparently TikTok, but we're only active on the first two. If you want to hear this episode again or catch up on any of our old episodes, you can find our podcast on Omni, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, at Represent, anywhere you get your podcasts. And as always, remember to stay political.
You've been listening to a Sin Media podcast, where young people run the show.